Now we're going to finish the first chapter of Colossians. We've been in it a long time because we have a lot of foundational understanding to get hold of here. But in a word, Paul is an oracle of God, an agent, a representative of God, communicating the truth of the new faith as related to the Jewish religion. Paul was a Jew, and Christianity was basically oriented to the Jewish faith because it started with the idea of God and the commandments. The Jews were the old era prophets or communicators of divine truth. All of the Old Testament is based upon God's teachings through the Jews about himself to the world. But there was an element that was not revealed to the Jewish people as yet because they were not ready to receive it. The fundamental element that was missing to the Jewish people was the work within the inner spirit. Now you see, the Jewish people were under the law, governed by a code or by rules or laws, but did not have the inner spiritual presence of God, that is, the presence of God in the spirit. They had teachings, laws, ideologies, but they did not have a divine presence within. The fundamental teaching of Paul is that now, since the coming of Christ, God has made possible the possession within the Spirit of the very Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, we call him. This came about after the resurrection of Christ, and he had promised his disciples that he would send his Spirit after he himself went back to his eternal identification with God. In the early stages of human action, disobedience brought a chasm between man and God. It brought upon the earth an evil trauma. That is, there was a slash, if you will, across society, which is what a trauma would represent. I think the word might not be amiss here. Trauma physically, a physical person means an open wound, trauma. On the psyche, it means an recognizable scar of some kind, an actual scar, rather than just a mild neurosis or a mild dysfunction. It's a real scar of some kind that brings about a mental disorientation of some kind. Now, I say to you that man's actions in the beginning of disobedience to God brought about a kind of trauma on the race, on the mind, that has left man in need of the actual touch from God to restore that relationship. Because mankind on the earth, does not, generally speaking, lean toward God. Generally speaking, mankind, or human persons on the earth, lean toward self-interest and toward the material world and toward nature rather than supernature, see? Things that are subject to the human senses. That is, the more obviously recognized senses, sight and touch and smell and so forth. So, we have been by virtue of early disorientation in the race of people to a position where there was a chasm between man and God. Now that chasm is bridged by the coming of Jesus into the world, where the eternal Godhead is brought into focus with man by the use of a man figure, Jesus. It says that in Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, thought it not something to be grasped, to be equal with God, but became lowly, took upon him the form of a man, and being found in fashion as a man, became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. In other words, the eternal God, or Godhead, came to the earth, who went even to the place of death as a sacrifice to bring about this reconciliation between man and God. Now, I said to you right at the beginning that the human mind cannot really process this adequately. It isn't capable of getting behind God's mind and understanding all that has happened. But God effects this in our spirit. I've used the analogy of the working of yeast in bread. You don't have to understand the chemical process taking place in that yeast to enjoy making bread or eating it. By the same token, we do not really understand all the implications of reconciliation, but we have the effects of it, and we know the effects of it in a very positive way. You know the effects of yeast in the dough because the dough rises. Now we know the effect of the Spirit of God in us, not by understanding the process, but recognizing that now we begin to care about God. We begin to believe in Him. It becomes a natural thing to accept the idea of God. It becomes a natural thing to care about the conduct of our life. That is a miraculous intervention from God. It is a greater miracle than healings, which people commonly look to for proof. That's a very poor proof, healings, because it really represents no proof at all, since you have numerous ways of reinterpreting or explaining. And there are so many ways that the human being is deceived, self-deceived and deceived by others. Medical reports get misapplied and many different things are. So healing is a really inadequate evidence. But when the mind is drawn toward that which it cannot possibly by itself fabricate, there is some power there. You see, your mind, the human mind, does not have a single model anywhere in the universe to fashion God after as we conceive God through the Scripture. There is no model. Yet there is a common sensitivity to the idea of God. Now, more particularly, there is a hanging on to the concept of God in the face of so many things to the contrary. a person that wants to believe in God, nevertheless, as a reasonable human being, will find a great many things that militate against believing in God. Many things on the earth. The many things unexplained completely. Many things I cannot explain to you and I haven't tried to explain. If you try to talk about a God of love and you see a great host of injustices, inequities, brutalities, you say to yourself, how could God make such a thing? Or how could he allow such a thing? That's a pretty valid problem. And it is one to which I don't have an answer. The miracle to me is that I think I'm a reasonable person. And I don't really look for anything in this world. I'm not trying to get God to do nice things for me. I keep talking the other way around. I keep telling people, don't expect God to do nice things for you. If you come to me and you want a nice life, forget it, because I don't know how to give you a nice life. Very few people have it that I know of anyway, you know, so. I mean, the world, it's not good enough to say, well, God has been so nice to me because I have this nice home and this nice family. And I cannot get over 7/8 of the population of the world that are in misery. I'm being very brutally frank with you when I say to you that there are too many things that militate against belief in God to say that it's just the mind reaching out for something it wants very much to believe in. It just isn't there. Now, there are people, perhaps, that do overlook those things and believe in God anyway. If a man, a person, a human being, on this little microcosm, this little tiny earth, is going to believe in a God who goes far beyond all natural phenomena, he's going to believe in that kind of God, there has got to be some spiritual intervention from God. In other words, there's got to be a touch from God that goes beyond natural capacity. Now, when I'm talking about that touch, I don't mean any feelings. I'm not talking about having some groovy feeling, but I'm saying that we can expect, if God exists, we can expect that there will come a conviction within that he does exist, if we want to believe, and we ask for that help. That's what we can expect. We cannot expect anything more than that. I cannot tell you that you can expect much in the way of feelings. I haven't had much for 30 years, so I don't know. I've never had much of that kind of experience. I've been exposed to a lot of it. I have to say that as far as genuine emotional experience is concerned, most of it seems to be pretty much fabricated. But that has not in any way dimmed the conviction within that God exists. People want an emotional experience, it's all right. I don't say they can't have it, but it isn't necessary. It is not a necessary accompaniment of the conviction that God exists. The Bible gives us a unique statement, because it is unique to all the books of the world, all the religious writings of the world. It is a unique statement because it is an extremely detailed statement of a very acceptable or tenable kind of God. I mean, contrasted with the Greek mythologies, for example, the hero gods of the Greek myths, the fantasies of much of the Indian literature, the various kinds of things that you can, where you get so much of grotesqueness to the gods of other religious groups, other writings. There's nothing grotesque about this. The Bible represents a very sane, very moderate presentation, and yet has enough of the element of greatness to it to inspire belief. But for all of that, I have to say to you that only God can open up our understanding or can give us the conviction that He is real. Now, I will go on to say, I made some comment about these religious writings, but I will go on to say that even though we may not really share all of the various differences or share the convictions of other religious people, yet I do have to go on to say to you that the soul of man, using the word soul as in a general sense, the soul of the individual all over the world reaches out for something beyond itself. I'm not sure that the chimpanzee does that, reaches out for something beyond itself to believe in. I'm not sure that he does. I think there's a difference here. And I think it can be, it's physiologically explained because of the lack of a frontal lobe in the animal, where no integration can take place of that kind. You see, the things that come to the brain via the various senses, you see, the impulses that come to the brain are integrated, as we say, in the frontal lobe, where thinking takes place and organizing of thought and the identification of things, the capacity of organizing names, like taxonomy, for example. All of these things are capacities of a brain that integrates the impulses that come to it, you see. I'm speaking in different terms, and you people probably, I do generally speak in different terms you may be accustomed to hearing in religious circles, but I'm trying to nail things down quite tightly if I can, so that we can relate to we human beings on the earth confronting the majesty of God, assuming Him to exist. It's so absurd to think that we can touch God or believe God that I'm trying to help us understand how that can be. His Spirit has come to us, but He has first prepared a ready instrument to put God in a human body. You'd expect there to have to be considerable modifications, but there were not. That says something for man. In fact, the psalmist says, "What is man that thou art mindful of?" Not putting man down, but lifting him up. What is man that he should be so tremendous, marvelous, that God Himself can be mindful of him, can possess him? So God has prepared us as vehicles through whom His Spirit can function in the world, even as He functioned through Jesus. And when Paul says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Jesus Christ," he's saying something quite grand there. I'm saying to all of you that there's only one way that this can ever come with impact upon us. Otherwise, there'd be skepticism, extreme skepticism. I'd be the biggest skeptic of all. There probably wouldn't be a greater cynic in the world than myself. I've been around too much. I am a cynic by nature. As far as this life and this world is concerned, the miracle to me is that an old cynic like myself can have such a conviction of the reality of God that even the staggering evidences to the contrary that confront us in the world world of inequities does not prevent that belief. And I do not try to defend God because I can't. I think if you can defend something, you're greater than that thing, you see. If you have the power to defend someone, in a way you lift yourself above that person. So I can't justify God or defend him myself. All I can say is that not everything that man has done has been ordained of God. The very nature of a being that is great enough to receive God, the Spirit of God, must also be great enough to get out of hand. It's like a complex machine, you see. If God makes man a free moral agent, he's also got to give him the liberty to louse himself up, which he does. So man has made an unholy mess of this world. We would like, as I've said to you before, we would like to feel sometimes that God could tie a string around a person's hand and then just before it got to your nose, jerk it away. But he doesn't do that. So people do louse things up, like I've often said about the automobile that the manufacturer makes is a pretty fair machine, but people do have the liberty to take it out and louse it up. We would have a lot fewer accidents if they put them all on tracks. And we could slot everybody into the freeways down here, three lanes or four lanes across, and just run them like slot cars, right? From Los Angeles to San Diego without a breath of troubles. But people wouldn't like that very much. And we could have a very nice world. If God would do that, it would be very nice. World of automatons, marionettes, puppets. But he didn't make it that way. He made it so that we are great enough as instruments that we can go off the track, and he doesn't correct that. So that's only a start at justification, but I don't defend him or justify him. I don't know what he's doing most of the time or why. But I come back to you on this point. Say, I brought up this word reconciliation, and I'm saying to you that God made a world, put human beings in it. They got off the track. Being capable of getting off the track, they did promptly. And God merely engineered a process by which they could be restored. But could not, of course, and did not, of course, coerce everyone to be restored. People don't have to believe it if they don't want to. I never press people on that thing. Somebody doesn't want to talk about God, that's no big deal to me. I don't like to feel that they're going to lose out, but that's all right. If somebody likes what they are and likes what they believe, that's their thing with me. I don't worry about that. Somebody comes to me and they say, I'd really like to know about God. Fine, I'll tell you about him. But if they don't want to know, I'm not going to push them. Because that's a private thing. And not everybody is going to follow God. And thank God I'm not responsible for seeing that they all do. I'm responsible for communicating what I know about it. My job is to take this Bible and teach it. And outside of that, I don't have anything to say much about who God is or what he is. Once we get outside the realm of the Bible, it's all speculation anyway. The Bible turns out to be, in my mind, a very cogent, very meaningful, useful guide to the knowledge of God. And that's my specialty. So, the exploration of the truth of God requires a touch of the Spirit of God, not to make us feel good, but to give our brains the capacity to come to terms with God, to have the conviction of God. And the general evidence that the Spirit of God is in you is the caring. I think that's the main thing I would say, the caring about it. The Spirit of God is working in your own spirit, if you care about knowing about him. To nail it shut and say that the moment God touches you, you have an absolute conviction and you never again doubt would be wrong. Because the human mind keeps getting in our way. But if we see the human person as a body, soul, and spirit, which the Bible tends to see, you have a brain that is a physiological instrument, a cortex with the knowledge being in more or less grooves on the cortex, a grid pattern on the cortex. That's where our knowledge is. That's where our learning takes place. That's where all the integration, that is the assembling of ideas, takes place in the brain. But there is something more than just the brain. There is a spirit. The spirit is more than the brain and governs the brain and supersedes it. I've used the analogy of the automobile. Automobile itself being the body, that is the body of the automobile, and it has an engine in it, which I might identify with a soul, and then it has a driver, which I could identify with a spirit, you see. An automobile will go down the street without a driver. It won't go very far, but it'll go. I mean, you can turn the ignition on and put it in gear, and it'll go down the street. It won't go very far without having trouble, but it will function. Now, the driver determines whether that automobile functions well or not. Whether the automobile becomes a weapon that goes out and kills people, or whether it becomes a useful vehicle for taking people down the road, depends on the driver. And that's something Detroit can't build into it. So the driver is the all-important element, but it's like the spirit. You see, the brain will function without the spirit in a way. And there are lots of ways in which the brain functions on a pure reflex basis. If you may, most high school people now get enough in, high school studies are pretty advanced these days as compared to 30, 40 years ago, but almost any high school kid now knows that you have a reflex system. When you touch something and pull your finger back as a hot iron, a typical illustration. And that's because an impulse has gone to the spinal column and returned immediately to the finger to pull it away. And then that triggers another impulse that goes up to the brain and gets involved in determining what to do about it. Throw the iron across the room or kick the cat or just what? That's what the brain determines for you. But the point I'm saying is that this whole physiological function can do fairly well without the Spirit of God in it. But what is made of all of that will be determined by the nature of that spirit of the individual. Some people take this marvelous mechanism and use it for evil purposes because they've got a spirit in them that is for evil. The spirit has got to be a link. Now, one can either elect, in the nature of things, one can either elect to identify with God or not to identify with Him. If one elects to identify with God, then the conditions have been made open by the coming of Jesus Christ to the world, and man has been reconciled to God through the coming of Christ, so that those who want to do so can respond to God, and the point of response is the Spirit. God functions through the Spirit in faith, in peace and joy and lots of things that the mind will not function in. Galatians 5:22 says the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, so forth. Now, love, joy, and peace are fruit of the Spirit, not of the mind. We have what passes for love, but it's pretty short-lived on the earth. We love people as long as they perform the way that we think they ought to. But that love goes pretty fast, cold. And faith is a hard commodity to retain in the brain. We have faith for a time and then we lose it for a time. As far as the brain is concerned, the confidence, if we see faith as merely a function of the brain in confidence about things, confidence about life, confidence about the chairs we sit on and so forth, that's a mental thing and comes and goes. But there's a deeper level where the faith of God functions in our spirit and holds us steadfast even while the brain is itself rocking quite a bit. So all of this really goes back to a point. The natural person is, by and large, governed by a natural world that he lives in, and sees only that natural world and is not able to go beyond that. But God, who is greater than the natural world, is beyond the natural world, is a spirit being, has the power to reach us beyond the mind in our spirit, and give us a deep sense of conviction of his presence and reality in spite of thoughts that vary considerably. So you can get up in the morning, and this is practical, it's not just ethereal. It's practical because it means you can get up in the morning with a bad day, a hangover, whatever you've got, and the world looks terrible, and you feel terrible, and you hate everybody, and you get up that way, and you go out about your work, and you feel maybe rotten all day, and yet you do not lose the sense that God is there. You're not a Christian today, and a non-Christian tomorrow, and a Christian the next day, and so on. You may not act very well. This whole thought that we act like Christians or not like Christians is pretty thin anyway. I don't really know how a Christian is supposed to act. I've seen a lot of them, and I'm not sure I've got a good norm here to present. So I'd rather not even use the expression, but let's just say you can act ornery or ugly or whatever. And God doesn't leave you. On the other hand, the presence of the Spirit of God within you may give you the capacity to cope with things better, and to maintain your equilibrium or your cool or whatever you want. Or even if you don't maintain your cool, you can just maintain the equilibrium and maintain your priorities, your perspective, your anchor point, all of that is steady. Yet while you struggle in the human realm with many things, but you don't have to say to yourself, well, I'm not a very good Christian, or I'm not a Christian because I do this and that, that is off base. God is greater than that. So much of religion has failed, or people have been disappointed in so much of religion because it tends to put too much weight on the human capacity to behave in a certain pattern. And it leaves us very unstable. I mean, it leaves our sense of God, a very insecure thing, because we're just not that able to function that consistently, day in and day out, in a noble way. But the Bible makes it very clear that our faith is not in ourselves, but in God. That His power to preserve us and to function through us, in spite of our human weaknesses, is there. The power of God is there to function in us and does function through us in spite of all of this. And so the Bible presents from one end to the other, it presents its characters for the most part in human weakness. It's a very unique thing about the Bible. Go from one end to the other, and you find your characters, Moses, Abraham, David, all the way down the line. They're people that have their human weaknesses. Peter had his rampantly. Most people know Peter more than anybody else for his weaknesses, denying Christ. Peter represents a very typical human person. And the message of the Bible is that through typical, normal human persons, the Spirit of God fulfills His purpose. And we are secure not because our human brains have captured God, but because God is greater than our brains, greater than the universe, and holds us steadfast.